The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the fifth and final day of this five-day Elder Sesshin here at Mountain Gate. And we are going to share a little bit more of Tony Packer's writings, again from her book, The Wonder of Presence and the Way of Meditative Inquiry. And we're going to start with this, which is something to ponder. The concept of beginning and ending is time produced by thought. In other words, the only time there is, really, the only time there is right here now. But the idea of breaking right here now into segments and conceiving of a past and a future as well as the present is all in the realm of ideas, all story. We spoke yesterday about how there's a phenomenon that many people experience when they are under the kind of intense stress demanding utter attention, as in, for example, a car accident, where time seems to stand still, or certainly go in slow motion. And it's a very interesting phenomena, but it comes about because people are so totally present that there's nobody being present. There is just the occurrence. There is just the being. And the time impression is simply that. It's an impression. It's an idea. It's not a reality. Can we see right now that beginning and end, getting someplace, which comes with our ideas of time, being somebody, wanting to get something I lack, are all products of the imagination? We don't normally experience life like this. Normally there's a center that we assume we are the center of, and we feel totally solid. Feels like we've got attributes and problem places. It feels like we are lacking certain things and may have some other things that are advantageous, talents or whatever. But all of it is just a bag of ideas. Who we are. Who is that? Really. When people have near-death experiences, they're changed. They see life differently after that. Did they become two different people? The before person and the after person? Or were both a set of concepts, stories, ideas? As long as this isn't clear, this body-mind remains tied up in knots. Can we see that thinking about tomorrow or about what is planned for dinner tonight is all conceptualization? We can think about food when there's actually no food in front of us. Tonight, quote-unquote, is a thought. Dinner, quote-unquote, is a thought. The future, quote-unquote, in which I will be enlightened, is a thought. Can we see it instantly? Can we see that a thought is always away from this present moment where time does not exist? When the food is right in front of us, are we just eating? Or are we thinking about wanting more? And then she talks about stages. There are various different teachings, even within Buddhism, that talk about stages. In fact, particularly in the Theravadin way of teaching, way of seeing things. But also the ancient Indian, as an East Indian, as in the time of the Buddha, or following the time of the Buddha, the Indians love to categorize things. They love to put numbers to things. And that's why you have however many gazillion bodhisattva mahasattvas filling this little teeny room that Vimalakirti is lying in bed in. And somehow they're all able to get in that room. And it probably stemmed from that Indian way of conceptualizing things, that they talk about the 10 stages of bodhisattva development. There's a koan that reads, a woman was sitting next to the Buddha in deep samadhi. And Manjushri, who's the bodhisattva of wisdom, and in essence the most developed bodhisattva, says to the Buddha, "What's she doing there?" And he says, "Well, why don't you wake her up and ask her yourself? Wake her out of her samadhi. She's not asleep. She's just totally absorbed in inner contemplation." And so Manjushri walks around her, snaps his fingers, and does all kinds of things and tries to wake her up, and she's still deep in samadhi. And so the Buddha says, "Well, why don't you call such and such bodhisattva from the lower realms? See if he can't waken her." And the bodhisattva that was called was one of the earlier stage bodhisattvas, one who was not a highly developed bodhisattva. And he instantly was able to wake the woman. And this is actually, this koan has a very deep, deep meaning. Far away from men, women, high, low, any of that. So don't think about those ideas with regard to this koan, because they're completely irrelevant. But nonetheless, if you look at the traditional teachings, which of course weren't written down until well after the Buddha died, 200 years, I think, after the Buddha died, it was possible to write them down. And till that time, they were carried in memory. And then there was the great Buddhist university at Nalanda, where monks studied and learned doctrine. That by that point, I think they probably called it something equivalent to doctrine, learned the teachings. And things began to be categorized, which of course is not within really the teaching in a sense. On the other hand, we can see it as skillful means. So what is time? When we think about, you know, here Sesshin is about to end and I didn't accomplish, or I did accomplish, what I intended to. All of that is ideas. Where's the me to accomplish or not accomplish? Where's the me to succeed or fail? Find that one, or I should say try to find that one, and don't just automatically assume it doesn't exist. Go for it. Try to find some concrete evidence that I exist. You can't point to the body. Are you identical to the moment you were born? That body went through lots of changes. What is the essence of that body? What is the essence that inhabits that body, makes it move, talk, see, think? Where did we come from? Or did we come from somewhere? Normally we don't think about these things, but it's worth pondering, searching for answers. Searching for understanding is really a better word. Answers imply words, but the answers that come through understanding have nothing to do with words. In fact, it's very difficult to put them into words, even as strongly and deeply as you recognize the truth. So she's talking about stages. Here in the work of this moment, we're not trying to mold ourselves to a preconceived path or stages. Teachings that postulate stages grab the thinking mind. We wonder what these stages are like, and trying to figure them out is an exercise in headaches. And of course, the main interest is, what stage am I in? How many more will I have to go through? When will I come to awakening? And then the grand assumption that it's a total, complete change, and never before do we go back into delusion. Awakening is like turning a light on. And then we can see the cobwebs. And then we can see the rotten fruit in the corner. And then we can see the dirt on the floor and the rest of it. And then it's up to us to clean that stuff up, clean it out, so that there's nothing interfering. And yet, it's not about getting rid of anything. How can we fathom that? We look at ourselves, we look at other people, we look at our lives, we look at the lives of other people, and we see places where they could improve, or places where they're dysfunctional and should definitely improve, or places where they're outstanding. And yet, the whole thing is perfect as it is. This is something that is greatly misunderstood. Can we drop the idea of stages and not pick it up again, even though it's prevalent in many traditions? Can we see and feel that any such conceptualization is already a straitjacket? Thought is so powerful. Thinking what I am now, what I will be next, judging myself about what I think I am and what I could be, the power of such thoughts cannot be overestimated. They prevent a presence and awareness that defies all definition. And then we're going to jump to chapter 8, which is entitled, What is the Me? A summer day, isn't it? This sounds like yesterday. Dark, cloudy, cool, moist, and windy. Amazing, this whole affair of the weather. We call it weather, but what is it really? Wind? Rain? Clouds slowly parting? Not the words spoken about it, but just this darkening, blowing, pounding, wetting, and then lightening up, blue sky appearing amid darkness and sunshine sparkling on wet grasses and leaves. In a little while, there will be frost, snow, and ice covers, and then warming again, melting, oozing water everywhere. On an early spring day, the dirt road sparkles with streams of wet silver. So, what is weather other than this incessant change of earthly conditions and all the human thoughts, feelings, and undertakings influenced by it? Like and dislike, depression and elation, creation and destruction, an ongoing, ever-changing stream of happenings abiding nowhere. And here's a clue. An ongoing, ever-changing stream of happenings abiding nowhere. And yet we take it to be solid, fixed, permanent. And when it shows itself as not permanent, we get dismayed. Try to grab it back. Or if it's permanent, we think, and we don't like it, and we try to get rid of it. All of this is story. All of this is ideas. What's the reality? Who are we really? It's as if this ability to think has gotten so far out of control. Like the sorcerer's apprentice with that broom and that bucket. Never ceasing, creating turbulence. An ongoing, ever-changing stream of happenings abiding nowhere. No real entity, whether, quote-unquote, exists anywhere except in thinking and talking about it. Now, is there such an entity as me or I? Or is it just like the weather, an ongoing, ever-changing stream of ideas, images, memories, projections, likes and dislikes, creation and destruction that thought keeps calling I, me, Tony, and thereby solidifying what is evanescence, or seemingly solidifying what is evanescent? What am I really, truly, and what do I merely think and believe I am? Are we interested in exploring this amazing affair of myself from moment to moment? Is this maybe the essence of this work? Many, many years ago in Rochester, it was very easy to see going around in Keeneheen that one of my Dharma brothers there living at the Rochester Zen Center was deeply absorbed, deeply absorbed. His body went around in Keeneheen. His body sat on the cushion. His mind was deeply curious. And he had a kensho in that sesshin. And afterwards he said, why didn't somebody tell me it's just about exploring your own mind? It's just about exploring your own mind. Chisan at Sogenji is said that the Zendo was really a laboratory for discovering, learning, exploring. It's not about me sitting on the cushion trying to find this ideal me that is enlightened. Enlightenment is here all the time. It's just this idea that we're a solid being. Fixed. It prevents that from happening, and it also straitjackets us, because if we think we are somebody with certain characteristics and certain abilities and certain likes and dislikes, then we get ourselves into situations and we're forced to behave out of that straitjacket, which is extraordinarily narrowing. And we wonder why we don't feel free. There you have it. Most human beings take it for granted that I am me, and that me is this body, this mind, this knowledge and sense of myself that feels so obviously distinct and separate from other people and from the nature around us. The language in which we talk to ourselves and to each other inevitably implies separate me's and you's all the time. It's very interesting that in Japan, the Japanese language, these personal pronouns are rarely used. Rarely used. You don't go around saying, I want this, or I think that, or I'm going there, or I just came back from here. You come back into the house and you say, itekimasu, which means arrived. You go out with somebody, or you're about to go out with somebody, or getting your coats on, you say, ikimashou ka, means shall go. And of course, in English, in order to translate it, we have to say, shall we go? But there's no we in that word. Burmese, the same. And in Burmese, it's interesting, there's not even a past or a present or a present or a future tense. There's only the present tense. But in English and in the Romance languages and in other languages in the world, in our so-called high-level cultures, there's an awful lot of I, me, you, them, and it breeds division. Where there is none. All of us talk, I and you talk. We think it, write it, read it, and dream it with rarely any pause. There's incessant reinforcement of the sense of me, separate from others, isolated, insulated me, not understood by others. How are we to come upon the truth if separateness is taken so much for granted and feels so common sense? The difficulty's not insurmountable. Wholeness, our true being, is here all the time. Like the sun behind the clouds. Light is here in spite of cloud cover. What makes up the clouds? Can we begin to realize that we live in conceptual, abstract ideas about ourselves? That we are rarely in touch directly with what actually is going on and we don't even realize that? Can we realize that thoughts about myself, I'm good or I'm bad, I'm liked or disliked, are nothing but thoughts? And the thoughts do not tell us the truth about what we really are or the truth about what anybody else is. A thought is a thought, and it triggers instant physical reactions, pleasures, and pains throughout the body-mind. Physical reactions generate further thoughts and feelings about myself. I'm suffering. I'm happy. I'm not as bright or as good-looking as the others. That feedback implies that all this is me, that I've gotten hurt or feel good about myself or that I need to defend myself or get more approval and love from others. When we're protecting ourselves in our daily relationships, we're not protecting ourselves from flying stones or bomb attacks. It's from words we're taking cover, from gestures, from coloration of voice and innuendo. We're protecting ourselves, we're taking cover. In using our common language, the implication is constantly created that there is someone real who's protecting and someone real that needs protection. Is there someone real to be protected from words and gestures? Or are we merely living in ideas and stories about me and you, all of it happening in the ongoing audio-video drama of ourselves? This is all so sadly true, and what is more sad is that we don't even realize it. We're caught in our ideas about ourselves and our ideas about ourselves in relation to others, and it causes untold suffering totally unnecessarily. Totally unnecessarily. The utmost care and attention is needed to see the internal drama fairly, accurately, dispassionately, in order to express it as it is seen. What we mean by being made to feel good or getting hurt is the internal enhancing of our own ongoing me story, or the puncturing and deflating of it. Enhancement or disturbance of the me story is accompanied by pleasurable energies or painful feelings and emotions throughout the organism. All because of a set of stories. All because of a bunch of ideas. Ideas that you can't even grab hold of something that's called an idea. It's so ephemeral, it's so elusive, it's so unreal. It's interesting that vision that Flora had of turning around one day in her gray little office and seeing that there's a full-length window onto an incredible view. And she could step outside and go into it, and it was alive, filled with life and color and energy, blooming, moving, changing and glorious in each moment. That is where we are when we are not caught in an idea, when we are totally, totally present. It's like that. We go from gray and black and white, two-dimension, into full technicolor, three-dimensional surround sound life. When we allow ourselves to totally be the moment without analyzing it, deconstructing it, commenting on it, judging on it. But to step from where we are to there can be what seems to be a very frightening prospect when we get close to it. Just like Flora's vision of being part of a family that lived in a dank, dark cave because it felt protected. And they screwed up the courage to go outside the cave, and there was light and air and potential. But everybody else is too scared to go out and risk being vulnerable. Went back and hid in the dark cave. And when we get close to our opening to what already is there, always was, always will be, it can feel scary, just like that, because we're going from what we are accustomed to, the seeming safety of an illusion of me, solid being, to a potential vanishing of that me. But again, to be totally present with whatever is coming up in each moment. This is why it's so important to be in your body and feel the sensations in your body, and not, it's so much easier when we do that to be present in the moment and not to get caught in thoughts. Let the thoughts take care of themselves. It's like the birds chirping outside, or the wind blowing, or the truck going down the highway, breaking with his gears. Blah, 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 blah. It's just that. Of course, it's easier to do that when there's just a truck going down the highway, because we're not invested in comments about it ordinarily, although some people would be. Jeez, why didn't he just use his brakes? Why does he have to brake with his gears? Downshifting. Why can't he leave this peaceful, quiet valley? Peaceful and quiet. Why does he have to interrupt it? Again, that's the idea of me getting defensive. What's the real me? Either warmth or chill can be felt at the drop of a word that evokes memories, feelings, passions. Conscious or unconscious, emotional recollections of what happened yesterday or long ago surge through the body-mind, causing feelings of happiness or sadness, affection or humiliation. Right now, words are being spoken and they can be followed literally. If they're fairly clear and logical, they can make sense intellectually. Perhaps at first it's necessary to understand intellectually what is going on in us, but that's not completely understanding the whole thing. These words point to something that may be directly seen and felt inwardly as the words are heard or read. And when we directly comprehend it, it's life-changing. When we hear it and intellectualize it, it's added to a story. Maybe an ideal story, but a story still. What we want to do, as Flora said, is know the truth. Not words about it. Not ideas about it. As we wake up from moment to moment, can we experience freshly, directly, when hurt or flattery is taking place? What's happening? What's being hurt? And what keeps the hurt going? Can there be some awareness of defenses arising, fear and anger forming, or withdrawal taking place, all accompanied by some kind of storyline? Can the whole drama become increasingly transparent? And in becoming increasingly transparent, can it be thoroughly questioned? As we become aware of these experiences in our body, it's important to stop for a moment, cock that eyebrow, look at that assumption quizzically. Is this really the truth? Is this really what's happening? Resist the urge to go down that path of feeling vindicated, of feeling powerful. Because feeling hurt can feel powerful, feel like we exist, or we can turn the knife inward. And the anger inward, and feel that knife plunging into our solar plexus, and it can feel good. But it's only habit, it's only idea. What's real? It's the reality that'll free us, not the idea. Find the reality. What is it that's being protected? What is it that gets hurt or flattered? Me? What is me? Is it images, ideas, memories? It's amazing. A spark of awareness, witnessing how one spoken word arouses pleasure or pain throughout the body mind. Can the instant connection between thought and sensations become palpable? The immediacy of it? No I entity directing it. Even though we say and believe I'm doing all that, it's just happening automatically. You're not even in control. It's just running the screen all by itself. With no one intending to do it. Those are all afterthoughts. We say, I didn't want to do that, as though we could have done otherwise. Words and reaction proceed along well-oiled pathways and interconnections. And every time we think a thought again, we reinforce that self-image. Be careful. See how circumstances bring up the same thoughts, going down, as she says, the same well-oiled pathways, bringing up the same feelings, and reinforcing the whole process. Reinforcing a story. Who is it? Feels that? Who is it that thinks that? What's really going on? A thought about the loss of a loved one comes up, and immediately the solar plexus tightens in pain. Fantasy of lovemaking occurs, and an ocean of pleasure ensues. Who does all that? Thought says, I do, I'm doing that to myself. But to whom is it happening? Thought says, to me, of course. Well, where and what is this I, this me, aside from all the thoughts and feelings, the palpitating heart, the painful and pleasure energies circulating through the organism? Who could possibly be doing it all with such amazing speed and precision? Thinking about ourselves and the triggering of physiological reactions takes time. And actually, at one point, and I did, I co-led an all-day sitting in New York City several years back, and there was a woman in the Sangha who had a very interesting work of teaching actors how to become their person that they were representing in a play or movie or whatever. Teaching them how to become that person. All we have to do, and it's interesting because I saw a movie with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn a while ago. I don't remember what the movie was, but in the end, there's this whole man-woman thing about whether women manipulate because of tears. And so Spencer pulls an act and announces that he's leaving and the marriage is dissolving. And so they talk about the farm that they had lovingly bought and ecstatically finally made the last payment on. And all of a sudden he bursts into tears. And she gets all soft and caring, and whereas before she was quite the opposite. And then he turns them off like clockwork and says, see, tears can work for me too. We think of a scene and the feelings about it come up. We can create in our own mind the emotions. We do create in our own mind the emotions, and they come from thought. Thought, image, memories. And yet we feel them as real as if they were seemingly happening. That should be a clue. We're very good at inventing our life, or I should say, the story of our life. As the reality of our life goes by, streaming in all its technicolor, surround sound, three-dimensional experience, except we're living in a dream. Of an old hand-cranked black and white movie. Right at this moment, wind is storming, windows are rattling, tree branches are creaking, and leaves are quivering. Is it all here in the listening? But whose listening is it? Mine? Yours? We say, I'm listening, or I cannot listen as well as you do. And these words befuddle the mind with feelings and emotions learned long ago. You may be protesting, my hearing isn't yours, your body isn't mine. We have thought like that for eons and behave accordingly. But at this moment, can there be just the sound of swaying trees and rustling leaves and fresh air from the open window cooling the skin? It's not happening to anyone. It's simply for present for all of us, isn't it? Do I sound as though I'm trying to convince you of something? A passion arising and trying to communicate simply, clearly, may be misunderstood for a desire to influence people. That's not the case. There's just the description of what is happening here for all of us. Nothing needs to be sold or bought. Can we simply listen and investigate what is being offered for exploration from moment to moment? What is the me that gets hurt or flattered time and time again the world over? In psychological terms, we say that we're identified with ourselves. In spiritual language, we say that we're attached to ourselves. What is this ourselves? Is it feeling of myself existing, knowing what I am, having lots of recollections about myself, all the ideas and pictures and feelings about myself strung together in a coherent story? And knowing this story very well, multitudes of memories, some added, some dropped, all interconnected. What I am, how I look, what my abilities and disabilities are, my education, my family, my name, my likes and dislikes, opinions, beliefs, and so on. The identification with all of that, which says, this is what I am. And the attachment to it, which says, I can't let go of it. Let's go beyond concepts and look directly into what we mean by them. If one says, I'm identified with my family name, what does it mean? Let me give you an example. As a growing child, I was very much identified with my last name because it was my father's and he was famous, so I was told. I liked to tell others about my father's scientific achievements to garner respect and pleasurable feelings for myself by impressing friends. I felt admiration through other people's eyes. It may not even have been there. It may have been projected. Perhaps some people even felt, what a bore she is. On the entrance door to our apartment, there was a little black polished brass plate with my father's name engraved on it and his titles, Professor Dr. Phil. The Phil impressed me particularly because I thought it meant that my father was a philosopher, which he was not. I must have had the idea that a philosopher was a particularly imposing personage. So I told some of my friends about it and brought them to look at the little brass sign at the door. As she was growing up in Germany, where professors are called Professor, Doctor, whatever. This is one meaning of identification, enhancing one's sense of self by incorporating ideas about other individuals or groups or one's possessions, achievements, transgressions, anything, and feeling that all of this is me. Feeling important about oneself generates amazingly addictive energies. And this is important. Amazingly addictive energies. We like those feelings that come up when we feel vindicated or when we feel put upon or when we feel lacking. We say, well, of course not, it hurts. If it hurts that much and you really don't want to be there, it should be relatively easy to let go and not go there again. To give another example from the past, I became very identified with my half-Jewish descent, not openly in Germany, where I mostly tried to hide it rather than display it, but later on after the war ended, telling people of our family's fate and finding welcome attention, instant sympathy, and nourishing interest in the story. One can become quite addicted to making the story of one's life impressive to others and to oneself and feed on the energies aroused by that. And when that sense of identification and attachment is disturbed by someone not buying into it, contesting it, or questioning it altogether, there's sudden insecurity, physical discomfort, anger, fear, and hurt. Becoming a member of a Zen center and engaging in spiritual practice, I realized one day that I'd been talking about my background, hadn't been talking about my background in a long while. And now when somebody brings it up, sometimes an interviewer will ask me to talk about it. It feels like so much bother and effort. I delve into old memory stuff. I want to talk about listening, the wind and the birds. Are we listening right now? Or are we more interested in identities and stories? We all love stories, don't we? Telling them and hearing them is wonderfully entertaining. At times, people wonder why I don't call myself a teacher when I'm so obviously engaged in teaching. Somebody actually brought it up this morning, the projections and the associations aroused in waiting outside the meeting room and then entering nervously with a pounding heart. Do images of teacher and student offer themselves automatically like clothes to put on and roles to play in these clothes? In giving talks and meeting with people, the student-teacher imagery does not have to be there. It belongs to a different level of existence. If images do come up, they're in the way, like clouds hiding the sun. Relating without images is the freshest, freest way in the universe. So what am I? And what are you? And what are we without images, clothing, and hiding our true being? It's unimaginable, isn't it? And yet, there's the sound of wind blowing, trees shaking, crows cawing, woodward creaking, breath flowing without need for any thoughts. Thoughts are grafted on top of what's actually going on right now. And in that grafted world, we happen to spend most of our lives and wonder why we're not feeling fulfilled. Yet every once in a while, whether one does meditation or not, the real world shines wondrously through everything. How is it when words fall silent, when there is no knowing, when there's no listener, and yet there's listening, awaring, in utter silence? The listening to the awaring of the me story is not part of the me. Awareness is not part of that network. The network cannot witness itself. It can think about itself and even change itself, establish new behavior patterns, but it cannot see itself or free itself. There's a whole psychological science called behavior modification that through reward and punishment tries to drop undesirable habits and adopt better, more sociable ones. It's not what we're talking about. The seeing, the awaring of the me movement is not part of the me movement. A moment during a visit with my parents in Switzerland comes to mind. I'd always had a difficult relationship with my mother. I'd been afraid of her. She was a very passionate woman with lots of anger, but also love. Once during that visit, I saw her standing in the dining room facing me. She was just standing there. And for no known reason, I suddenly saw her without the past. There was no image of her, and also no idea of what she saw in me. All that was gone. There was nothing left except pure love for this woman. Such beauty shone out of her. Such beauty shone out of her. We don't know what she looked like. But the beauty shone out of her. It wasn't superficial. It wasn't cosmetic. And our relation changed. There was a new closeness. No one changed it. It just happened. Truly seeing is freeing beyond imagination. Truly seeing is freeing beyond imagination. Dare to go there. Dare to go there. Step into it. Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.